The Mystery of Disobedience. That's the subject of an important new book by A.L. Press. He's written for The Nation, The New York Review, The New York Times Magazine, and others. Last time he was here, we talked about his award-winning book, Absolute Convictions, about his father, who was an abortion provider in Buffalo and who was targeted by anti-abortion protests. Now he has a new book out. It's called Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. A.L. Press, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
Well, we all think we would say no to injustice. We would join the resistance. We would not stand by because we have principles. We have strong convictions. But in fact, most of the time, almost everybody goes along with what's happening. You've studied some of the exceptions. You've asked why a few ordinary people took big risks to do what was right when everybody else around them didn't. What got you into this topic?
Well, one of the things that got me into it was, as you mentioned in your opening right there, we do tend to overestimate, I think, how principled we ourselves would be in these situations, forgetting the incredible social pressure that resistance in just about any context, not just in an authoritarian country, but also in a democratic society, how much courage it requires, and how much you will be left alone and vilified. And that is certainly one of the themes of the book and one of the things that interested me as I was exploring it. I also felt I wanted to, in a sense, engage an issue that I think all of us view in a somewhat ambivalent or maybe even hypocritical way. We tend to admire resistors and people who say no to orders and to the groupthink and so forth very much from a distance. When they stand against the current far away from us, say in Rwanda or in the context of World War II against Nazism. But when we find these people closer to home among us in our workplaces or say questioning the government or questioning power in our own society, it's much harder to admire them. And some of the stories I tell in the book illustrate this very dramatically.
Well, let's start with one of your cases that is close to home. The story of a financial advisor in Texas who blew the whistle on her corrupt Texas employer. This case, Stanford Financial, ended with the conviction of the CEO, Alan Stanford, for running a Ponzi scheme based at a bank in the Caribbean. And the one person who stood up on this was an employee named, what's her name, Layla Weidler?
Yes, Layla Weidler was a broker hired at Stanford in 2000, and like everyone else there, she was encouraged and eventually actually pressured to sell certificates of deposit at the affiliated offshore bank. And Stanford told brokers, you know, this is a great product, it gets very high returns, and it's very safe. And of course, that instantly struck Layla, as it should have struck others, as somewhat suspect. I mean, if something is getting, you know, 7 to 10% returns every year, how exactly is it safe? And so she asked to see what the bank's portfolio was, what it was investing in. The information was not shared with her. She inquired about whether the CDs were insured. She found out that they were not. She asked one too many questions, and in 2002, she was fired without any explanation. A year later, she sent a letter to the SEC and also to several newspapers stating her suspicion, writing out her suspicion that there was a massive fraud going on, and this was, if you remember, this was shortly after the Enron scandal, and Layla was in Houston, Texas, where Stanford was based. So she was worried that something similar was happening. She wrote this letter in 2003. No one responded to her. She followed the letter up with phone calls after she lost an arbitration case, where she was required to pay to reach a settlement in which she paid Stanford $50,000. She followed it up with phone calls, and she did reach someone at the SEC in the local Texas branch, but nothing came of that. And it took until 4.5 years later for someone at the SEC to finally call Layla Wydler and say, we want to talk to you about a former employer of yours. You can guess who that employer was. And, of course, in February of 2009, it was revealed that Stanford had been running a $7 billion Ponzi scheme.
Second biggest Ponzi scheme in the history of the world, I believe.
Yes. And what her case illustrates is something I think that is very important about the kind of dissent I write about and how it is treated in our country, which is that, you know, Layla, for speaking out, Layla was not imprisoned. She was not, no one forcibly silenced her. And in that sense, she exercised a free speech right, which is a very important right. But that right doesn't mean all that much if nobody listens to you. And that is indeed what happened in Layla Wydler's case. Unfortunately, it is all too often what happens in the case of corporate whistleblowers. The same exact thing, the same story with the Madoff Ponzi scheme, where you did have a whistleblower, Harry Markopoulos, who tried to warn repeatedly that this was a Ponzi scheme, that the returns were impossible. Again, no one listened. So, you know, one of the themes of the book is that that people who do stand up and stand on their principles, it obviously takes enormous courage to do this. You take great risks. And maybe it's true that most people would not be able to do this themselves, if we're honest about it. But surely we can pay more attention to the people who do take these risks, not just dismiss them with the labels they so often get, which is, you know, traitor or turncoat or, you know, disloyal or just plain, you know, the sort of crazy person who's you know, got a suspicion that isn't really warranted. Well, often it's at least worth asking the same question oneself.
One of the many interesting things about this, the whistleblower in the Stanford case, Layla Wydler, is she's not a anti-corporate activist. She's just an ethical broker, a stockbroker who wants to protect her clients.
Well, that's actually true of every character in my book. I think we have a notion that dissent is always carried out by people who have a kind of rebellious streak.
By people like us.
Yes, people who have always been questioning authority and the majority opinion, but the type of dissent I'm writing about is the dissent of the conscientious insider. And if you read studies of whistleblowers, or if you read about, in another example I give, is an Israeli soldier who becomes a refusenik. Well, if you read about who refuses to serve in the occupied territories, he, like Layla Wydler, was not a radical. Actually, he was a very avid patriot. He believed very much in the moral mission when he joined and started serving in the Israeli army. And what happens is that the people who, in a sense, these are by-the-book idealists, and they believe very much in the ideals of the system, when they see the reality that veers so much from the principles they were told, they have a crisis of conscience. They can't square the two. And so that's really the dynamic that plays out in the book.
So if you've just tuned in, we're speaking with A.L. Press about his important new book. It's called Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Let's talk a little bit more about your Israeli refusenik, Avner Wishnitzer. What happened to him after he refused to serve in the West Bank?
Well, Avner went from being, it would be beyond a respected soldier, a really kind of among patriotic and nationalist Israelis, a kind of revered figure, because he had served in the most elite unit in the Israeli army, Sayeret Matkal. And as I describe in the book, he underwent a gradual awakening. He visited for the first time places in the West Bank where he saw Palestinians being mistreated and harassed, and the army either standing by or actually protecting Jewish settlers who were engaging in these acts. And he came to the point where he told his commander, I will not serve in the occupied territories. That's not to say he wouldn't serve his country. He said, I will serve, but not in the occupied territories. So it was an act of selective moral refusal. And what happened to him, you know, he told me that before this, he thought he had prepared himself for the he knew that people would criticize him, that he'd get criticized in the media and so forth. He thought he was ready, and he also thought, you know, I'm a pretty brave guy. I've served in the most elite unit in the army. I've risked my life. This won't be too hard. He then told me it turned out to be 10 times harder than anything he'd done before, and he was completely unprepared for the sense of the criticism and the sense of being ostracized, in a sense being placed outside of the consensus of the mainstream. Yet, in doing that, Avner didn't stop there. He eventually found a new community and went from being a refusenik to actually a peace activist. And today he is one of the founding members of a group called Combatants for Peace. This is a group composed of Israelis and Palestinians who have decided to put their guns down to reach a just settlement to the conflict, which they believe cannot be reached through violence.
We're speaking with A.L. Press about his new book, Beautiful Souls. And then there is, in some ways, the most fascinating character of all in your book, the Swiss border guard on the eve of World War II. We know a lot about, or people who are interested in this issue know a lot about Polish Gentiles who protected Jews in the darkest days of World War II. This is a little bit different. It's Switzerland. It's not Poland. World War II has not yet broken out. What's the story of Paul Gruninger?
It's an amazing story. Gruninger is, again, a conservative, patriotic guy. He's a police captain in an area of Switzerland that borders Austria. And in 1938, Nazi Germany annexes Austria and starts terrorizing Jews there. And Kristallnacht happens, and Jews start fleeing, trying to get out of the country. Right then and there, the Swiss government adopts a new policy saying that Jewish refugees should not be admitted and that this restriction should be enforced, the direct quote is, without exception. And Gruninger, alone among the people who are asked to enforce this order, violates it. He allows hundreds, possibly thousands, we don't actually know the exact number, of Jews into Switzerland against the law. He's eventually caught and subjected to terrible reprisal, losing his job and actually dying with his name disgraced. He was not officially rehabilitated until 1993, 21 years after he had died. But what's important about his story, and what connects to other stories in the book about it, is why he did this. And part of it, as I say, is this sort of conservative, almost traditional identification with the kind of ideals. Switzerland has always presented itself as this kind of nation of refugees, you know, that this safe haven for the persecuted. And Gruninger really believed this. So he thought he would be forgiven. He thought everyone would understand what he was doing. Of course, he was wrong about that. But the other reason he did what he did is that he made a big mistake, at least in the view of the Swiss authorities. He did not delegate the task of turning these refugees away to someone below him in the chain of command. He let the refugees come directly to the police headquarters. He met with them. He spoke with them. He saw the desperation in their eyes. And one of the themes in the book, again, if I can connect it to the Israeli character, well, it's seeing and talking to Palestinians that starts changing his mind about what's going on in the occupied territories. In Gruninger's case, it's seeing and talking to the people who are desperately trying to get into Switzerland that leads him to, as he then told his daughter, who I interview in the book, he says, you know, I couldn't do anything else. And that's not really true. Of course, he could have enforced the law, and many people did. But there is no question that various experiments have shown this, historical studies have shown this. When we are distant from the people who will suffer from the consequences of malicious orders, it becomes very easy to go along. You don't see the victims. You don't hear the cries. You don't feel a sense of responsibility. Closer at hand when it's you directly doing it, when you, in a sense, see the consequence all too closely, it becomes much more difficult and resistance becomes much more possible and common.
There are some readers and some reviewers who want a kind of unified theory from you explaining why these people said I couldn't do anything else. But, you know, I'm not sure there is a theory that explains them. Sometimes some people do unexpected things that take a lot of courage, and frankly, it's hard to explain why.
The reason I wrote this book and what I hope everyone can take away from it is instead of asking the question, well, what is it about these people that is so different and why did they do what they do, that people who read it apply the lesson and the questions to their own lives. We all find ourselves in situations where we are thrust into some kind of morally compromising situation. We have to choose, you know, should I compromise here? Should I stand by what I believe in? It can happen in very prosaic situations. It can happen in very dramatic situations. The point of the book is to get readers and all of us, in a sense, talking about why not only do we not stop and pause and think about what it would take to stand by our principles, but also why when people do that, again, we don't pay enough attention to them, and all too often they are vilified and ignored.
Eyal Press, his new book is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Thank you, Eyal.
Thank you for having me on, John.